Good morning, everyone. Here from Finland, it's very, very dark. And we, you know, we go into days here that are remarkably short. But the further north we go, the darker it gets. There's just a few of us here today, you know, when I do some of these in the morning. It's pretty much the middle of the night in the United States, but I'm happy to see you here, those of you who've been able to make it, and Annette and Isabel, Martine and Nathalie and Margot, and Michael keeping things on track. I always, these days, begin with a little notification of the progress that we're making in the post-election period during this defense of democracy. Now, today in the United States is the Thanksgiving Day. At least it is beginning. The Thursday is beginning. And it's a very unusual Thanksgiving because the pandemic is raging out of control due to neglect and a certain non-caring attitude of the administration, which is apparently now going out of power. There are still days left. Is it 55 days, approximately 56, 55 days, something like that, before the inauguration? And during that time, much mischief can occur, and that's why we have to keep up our steady application. The numbers in the pandemic are unacceptable. What is it? Well over 150,000 people are infected every day. Can you imagine such a number? And constantly over 1,000 people are dying every day from this pandemic. So that will affect the economy, which is splitting between those who are making huge sums of money from it and those who are impoverished by it. Further, there is the brewing possibility of an attack on Iran, which could lead to the imposition of martial law. And perhaps because of that, to the abrogation of the normal transfer of power. Because in martial law, gives the executive branch complete power, unless it is counteracted by the military, and then we have some kind of coup situation going on. So things are very serious. And then, of course, there's the whole question of the runoff that will occur in Georgia and will determine whether the programs of those who represent the indigo, the blue, can get through the Senate or not. Because if both of those runoffs are not won by the blue, I think it was January 5th, I think Michael told me yesterday, January 5th, the runoff, the vote, unless the blue group wins both of them, there will be an ongoing stalemate and blockage because of the Senate's refusal to pass the legislation which is so needed, and even the legislation which is needed to help reasonably to stem this epidemic, something which has not yet been applied in the United States. So we're getting kind of a perfect storm of difficulties coming together. And we do our work behind the scenes as members and aspiring members of the new group of world servers. We meditate the plan into existence at this fraught time. So when we see how the forces trying to clear the way for evil are aligning themselves and attempting to block the better way, we realize we have our work to do. So here then is our great invocation number 2. And we'll say that together with these thoughts in mind. First, to align, let us say, as aspiring members or as members of the new group of world servers. And we, the few of us that there are here, nonetheless, we come together in the silence and feel our solidarity. And we feel how within the new group of world servers we can make an esoteric difference. Let the Lords of Liberation issue forth. Let them bring succor to the sons of men. Let the rider from the secret place come forth and coming save. Come forth, O Mighty One. Let the souls of men awaken to the light, and may they stand with massed intent. Let the fiat of the Lord go forth. The end of woe has come. Come forth, O Mighty One. The hour of service of the saving force has now arrived. Let it be spread abroad, O Mighty One. Let light and love and power and death fulfill the purpose of the coming one. The will to save is here. The love to carry forth the work is widely spread abroad. The active aid of all who know the truth is also here. Come forth, O Mighty One, and blend these three. Construct a great defending wall. The rule of evil now must end. Well, we might wonder why in the midst of so much tribulation, and remember that in the book of Revelation, the time of the tribulation was highlighted, and you know, people sort of expect this is the end of the world, but that's a very narrow point of view. It's a testing time under Pluto and Vulcan, before the Christ can reappear. And his reappearance, let us remember, indicates that humanity has taken, or at least in the numbers that can take it, has taken the first initiation. So we're really right in the middle of the first initiation process, building toward that time. We are not supposed to speculate with any kind of authoritative attitude about when the Christ will reappear. He knows the condition that will allow him to do that, and it's not necessarily fixed to one particular date, but it is, I think, fixed to certain conditions, and those conditions, toward them we must work. The sharing, governing, international, national and international interrelations, the measure of peace restored, and the general house cleaning that's needed, as we can well see, in the political and church groups. So, in this incarnation, in the incarnation to come, I think we'll be hard at work with the preparatory activities, because so much has to be done in the five great planetary centers before the Christ can reappear on that great wave of expectancy. So you might wonder, you know, what are we doing studying here these deeply ontological matters? Ontology is the study of being. But every once in a while, we have to remind ourselves of a deeper level of reality behind the phantasmagoria. What a word. Behind the phantasmagoria of which the Tibetan speaks, and he says, including associated persons. Before us is the Mahamaya, all this world of precipitated forms, whether precipitated through the emanative process of the universal God, the universal Logos, or precipitated through lesser creators who are themselves emanations of the universal Logos. So we live in a world of illusion, we have to take it seriously because we do this forever. It's called the Maya, the Mahamaya. And as the great sage Shankara has said, most mysterious is Maya, and forever. I think we all have trouble with the forever concept, because according to the limitations of our normal perceptual apparatus, we're dealing customarily with states that have beginning and end. But in foreverness, there is that very hard to fathom beginninglessness, and then, of course, endlessness. I always have a little more trouble with beginninglessness than endlessness. But we have to accustom our concrete thinking apparatus to such concepts. They are deeply ontological concepts, and they show us our permanence in the world of universes produced by the great breath, according to the stanzas of Zian. So, you know, we try to solve many problems in the Mahamaya, and of course we have to, because that is the realm of good and evil. When there is adherence to the universal designs, the universal archetypes, then there is good. And when there is dissonance with the universal archetypes, there is what we call evil. Now, reality, if we can fathom it, is beyond good and evil. Nietzsche wrote something along that line. I don't know if he meant the same thing as I'm trying to mean, or, you know, that we find in Brahmanism and Vedantism. Because being per se is non-comparable and beyond good and evil. So that's something to bear in mind. Just endless, endless instances of good and evil have occurred in this never-ending and never-beginning apparent sequence of universes. And what are you left with finally, after it's all over, which it never is? You're left with absolute infinitude, which is the universe transcending deity's articulated self-image. And beyond that, you're left with something that can't even be spoken and is beyond the range of all, well, she says all human thought and expression, but I do think it's beyond the range of all intra-universe thought. In other words, absoluteness, we give it a name. But finally, that's it. That's all there is. So you know how we've been doing this a little bit. It's kind of a like a little lecture, but it's more of a meditative lecture. So we kind of go slowly and we ponder as we go, you know. And I know there are now a few more of us here. Catherine and Kim and Tia and Martine. And I maybe I've mentioned some of you before, but welcome. You know, I know it's some of you are defying the laws of sleep in order to be here. So I thank you for your presence. And, you know, if it's not possible to actually attend in person, you know, these are put up on Makara and increasingly on our YouTube channel, Moria Federation. Esoteric education, and you know they can be reviewed at leisure. So there's a kind of stillness that is required to begin to register a deeper reality which underlies all things. And we we're looking for the self. It's just very simple. And the self is not anything. And you know, normally when we say, I try to understand myself and so forth, we are looking at understanding the workings of our personality, our emotional vehicle, our mental vehicle, and the entirety of our mask. Which is the personality, and we can go further. We're trying to understand who we are within the Temple of Solomon on the higher mental plane. And we can go further and further. One day, as Chohans, we will awaken to a point of tension, reawaken really, to a point of tension within the monadic vehicle, the temple of Ezekiel, as it is called. All this is looking for the self, the essence that we are, and which is not describable in conventional, formal terms. And in the stillness, we may discover this. Be still and know that I am God. It's such a potent statement. And in that stillness, we don't move our perceptual apparatus from thing to thing to thing, you know. We maintain a certain fixation, and we maintain a, what can I call it, an infusceptive fixation. It's as if our apparatus for registration is fixed upon being, which is detected through infusception. So, you know, we're not looking for something that you can divide up, you know, into parts and pieces. In the Mahamayavic world of form, whether it's subtle forms or more obvious forms, this world seems to have a lot of parts. We probably don't even think of it, but we go through our life, our incarnation, dealing with multiplicity, and our attention shifts from one thing to another, from one perception to another. We open the car door, we sit on the seat, we take the steering wheel in our hands, we look for other cars coming, we turn out into the street, we drive along and many things pass us. It's all the many. We just even become unconscious to the manyness that is around us. And all of these many are distinct from each other. We know where one perception begins and another ends, at least we think we do. We take manyness for granted. It just seems so obvious that we don't even pay attention. You know, there's that old nursery rhyme, "The world's so full of a number of things. Shouldn't we all be as happy as kings?" Well, I don't think kings are very happy, as Damocles found out with that sword suspended by a hair above him when he was told to sit in the throne of the king. We live in a world of the many, and a great spiritual step is to reduce the many to the one. And it's very hard to say, you know, how you can go about that. Maybe everyone has their own way, just like everyone builds the Antikorana in his or her own way. What I've said before is that we are, it's an unusual, you know, phrase here, but I said we are skimming being off the perceptual impressions of form. See, when looking at a gestalt, a wholeness in our perceptual apparatus, or when registering a number of things simultaneously. When do we stop registering the things and begin to register the substratum out of which all those things have arisen? You and I have arisen from this same substratum. We are this substratum. If we can go deep enough and sensitive enough, we are each other and everything. Now, you know, some will say, well, that's really a useless kind of realization. But I don't think so. It's a whole nother dimension in the appreciation of the nature of reality, the nature of the self. See, basically, what we're looking for here is the in-universe self. We're familiar with the idea that there's not always a universe. A universe is a huge self-perception, and that particular self-perception, huge though finite, does not always exist. According to the great breath, it is intermittent. So we're looking for the in-universe self, which is our self, yourself, myself, the self. Not so that we can become useless, but in fact, more capable of identification within manyness. Now you know how it works with the many. Some of that many you care about, and some of that you don't. You know, we say, I mind my own business. That's not my concern. Someone else's responsibility. Well, that's true in the world of Mahamaya. Not all of the many are equally impressive to us. Or we don't seem to be equally related to every aspect of the many, at least in our normal consciousness, even a quite high consciousness. But related to is one thing, and identifying as is another thing. I don't really mean thing, you know what I mean. Language, the kind of language we're bound to use at this time is availing upon a deeper truth that we might be perceiving. So this carrying this idea that you are identified in the many as the many, I'll put it down. We are to be identified in the many as the many. Think about that for a minute. See, this is way beyond the normal good and evil that we have to attend to in our normal waking consciousness. You know, serious things are happening, and in this Mahamaya, people and different kingdoms of nature are suffering unnecessarily. And if we work towards the good, then we can reduce that suffering and bring in the intended joy and the intended bliss even. But through the heart and the stillness of the heart, in a way, doesn't mean it stops beating, okay, but through the stillness of the heart, one can begin to approximate the kind of identification of which the Christ is the great expert along the secondary line, at least the expert related to our humanity on this planet. So it's just a polarization between division and non-division. Can you look into the face of division, apparent division, and yet be so identified as the substratum out of which that division came, that division fades right before your eyes, as it were? I go on to think that it's not so much through the eyes, the two eyes, that this happens, but more through this series of hearts, the heart between the shoulder blades, the heart in the head, and the higher instance of that found on the astral plane. Through the causal body, it's a heart. And through the monadic vehicle, that's a heart too. As DK hints in Esoteric Healing. So my ongoing thought is that it's worth spending a little illusory time on these realizations. Because, you see, if we can't, you know, I'm using a strange phrase, but if we cannot skim being off of perceptual impression, so to speak, we are trapped in the perceptual expression. We're trapped in the Mahamaya. And, you know, in a way, from a quite high point of view, we're walking around within the veil of ignorance. We are just one of the many. Instead of being all of the many. So you can imagine that we've spent many incarnations, and I'm just speaking, you know, of this cosmos, this galaxy, this instance in apparent space. We've spent just ages being one of the many. Instead of being all of the many, or the one that is the many. We do have to solve that problem. You know, the initiate consciousness, which eventually we will all demonstrate, has as one of its major processes the solution of the problem of the one and the many. Now, life is turbulent. These are stressful times. So many of the energies that we might perceive are in discord with each other right now. There are storms and turmoils and wars and all manner of non-archetypal frictions. So we are disturbed. And the disturbance is likely to go on. I think there's a crescendo of disturbance to be expected before the great conclave. So, you know, getting supremely narcissistic and selfish people out of office is a step, but there are fundamental divisions. The Christ says, I come to bring not peace, but the sword of discrimination. And when different groupings of people, let's keep it in the human kingdom here for a minute, when they are forced into the same apparent space and they are at different developmental levels, educational levels, experiential levels, there's going to be big frictions. And that's not going away. I don't know what to say about the years from, let's say, 2025 to 2117 or 2125, you know, the beginning of the Aquarian Age, technically speaking. I think there will still be a lot of turbulence. Otherwise, Blavatsky would not have to speak about occultism winning the day by the end of the 21st century. if you're going to win something, there's going to be a struggle. So I don't expect a quiet time following the emergence, the actual emergence of the masters into the planetary centers that they will occupy when they are consulted regarding their wisdom, because they have proven themselves before the eyes of communities, governments, nations. That's not going to be an easy time. Nothing easy. There will be, well, you know, the old saying, symbolic, of course, that Satan, given as the personality, will be bound for 1,000 years. But that's not immediate. First, the struggle. And if we think about the individual human being, does it necessarily mean that everything gets easy after the individual human being takes the first initiation? Not at all. A long period of struggle with glamour supervenes life after life, in many cases, before the second initiation can be taken. So if we take the analogy, it's when the Christ reappears, it's not going to suddenly just be peace and everybody's happy. There is a struggle with the ancient obstructive ways. So we have to be ready for that. And we have to be able to remind ourselves, well, yes, all of this is illusion in the ultimate sense, but it is a necessary, cyclic, and ongoing illusion, which is the demonstration of the self-becoming creativity of the great super universal logos, the transcendental God beyond the universe. So it's a game, it's a play, it's a drama, it's a dance, and it is serious. It's a dual attitude that we have to have. And in that dual attitude, we can ignore the form while paying attention to the form. It's paradoxical, isn't it? We really have to pay close attention to the interrelationships of form, forms, and at the same time to realize the substratum, which is this kind of sameness in being, which underlies all interactions of the form. And so what we're trying to do in this little approach, which is different from every other day, where we're, you know, just much more normal, conventional, dealing with good and evil, and with the plan, and with the archetype, and with progress, you know, all the normal things, we're trying to register this ontological sustainer of the form, And for a few minutes, not so much the form itself. We're looking for something. There was a poet, English poet, Wordsworth, and he spoke of something far more deeply interfused, you know, hence my coining of the word infusception. He saw so many abuses around him. It was the time of the Industrial Revolution, sweeping through England, through the United, well, through Great Britain. And many people were suffering due to the attitudes, due to the dark satanic mills, you know, the factories of the time, where the workers were just put in inhumane conditions. But he also had this natural pantheism, an enlightened pantheism, which Madame Blavatsky hints at, speaks of, says that the true initiate is the pantheist. He also had that and could sense this something far more deeply interfused. So when you're working with this infusception and this all-pervading isness, which is yourself, you can temporarily ignore the fine detail of the form when you're, you know, deeply into the realization of that which has become all form. Of course, I suppose the masters and still more exalted souls can sustain both simultaneously. But the attention shifts, of course. So the time can come when every particularity is visible to an individual, and so is the only one thing, the ontological sustainer. For most of us, as we're getting into it, okay, we learn for a few minutes a day or however often to ignore the usual lure of form. Why do we do that? Well, because our objective is to find the self. You know, it reminds us of Yogananda and his self-realization fellowship. A great ideal. Can everybody understand it? Well, probably everybody has not understood it. It's very subtle. And that's why we, for a little while, ignore the particularities of the form. And then maybe later, when we are masters and Chohans and whatever we become, rays, planetary logoi, spirits on the cosmic astral and cosmic physical, cosmic astral and cosmic mental planes and beyond, Solar Logo and beyond, we can deal with realization and particularization at the same time. But to get started, we have to skim realization off of particularization. And I think the chain of hearts is what does that. If we can use the chain of hearts. Okay, so this, I think I've gone far enough in this now, the end of identify as being. And Michael, do we know what number we're on here? Because I certainly have lost it.
We are on number 24.
Okay, thank you. End of identify as being, program 24. This is, I get going in this slow lecture mode, which is half a meditation, and it's easy to get absorbed in it. There's a lot to discuss coming up about the whole concept of here and there. The whole idea of extension or non-extension. When we perceive the many, space becomes a factor. And we have the idea of extension in space, the filling of apparent space, which Kant would call a category of consciousness, and the filling of apparent time, extension in time. Now we can, what we want to do maybe next time is to establish that these are Mahamayavic actualities. In other words, we deal with them forever, cyclically. But there are really no, there is no extension. There is no space. There is no time. There is the superimposition of all diminishing points in apparent space, so that, to put it crudely, it's all happening here, it's only here, and even that is inadequate. And to put it crudely, again, it's all, if anything's happening, it's all happening now, forever. Now, some of these are hard concepts because they're so different from the way we usually think with our concrete mind. And pretty much that's how we think. But, you know, every once in a while you can go underneath the usual habits of thought and discover something quite unusual that will maybe make a difference, a positive difference, in how you live in apparent spatial extension and apparent temporal extension. So, you know, I'll just How do we, after all, live in apparent spatial extension and apparent temporal extension? You know, it's these are fundamental ontological questions. They have nothing to do necessarily, normally, with making a success of how we handle the many. Because, you know, we're all in this world of the many and in the world of apparent extension. Oh, that was then, this is now, that's going to be. Oh, that was there, this is here. This other thing is somewhere else. You know, those are our normal categories of thought. But every once in a while, you know, I'm always saying that, we can drop those customary categories. So, you know, we have to learn we have to learn to drop customary perceptual categories. And it will help us deal, as we must, with those very categories in the field of actuality. So we're just practicing methods of seeing, registering from an altogether different point of view. Just as long as we know what we're doing here, you know. It's only once a week. And it's not all of our normal concerns. You know, who won the election? Will there be justice? Will there be democracy? Will there be war? Will the disease overcome all of humanity? Will humanity be wiped out? Will we have to start all over again? You know, all of those are vitally important questions, but they are in a different category altogether. Okay, well, so that is maybe what will be coming up next time when we meet, which will be an evening thing. At so far at 6 o'clock. Now, see, normally when there's daylight saving time here in Europe, we meet at 5 a.m. and 5 p.m. GMT. But when we're back to standard time, we meet at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. And of course, tonight there will be the reappearance of the Christ meditation. And I think so. And there will be also our ongoing vigil meditation, where we're where we are in the relative world, fighting for the preservation of the will of the people. We're fighting for democracy in the relative world, and that will be at 8 o'clock p.m. GMT. So we have, you know, three programs today, as usual these days. Okay. Now, if you have any thoughts that you would like to bring up, I'll ask Michael to kind of help me here with this. And
yes, Isabel has written into the chat box. Each moment must be guarded, made worth the while somehow. There is no other moment. It always is just now. Just now has no beginning. Just now shall never end. And she says that this is quoting from an English or an American poet.
Thank you. It's a profound thoughts. You know, the interesting thing here, you know, if you really carry this to extremes, that moments themselves are an apparency. There appear to be moments. You know, that was a great moment in my life. The moment this happened and so forth, but the moment itself is not even measurable. It keeps on becoming less and less and less. Now, for practical purposes and for poetic purposes, we have to, of course, talk about moments. You know, there is a practical language. There is a language that will get ever more refined until we can speak or display the sensar in the relative world. And we must cultivate those things because we do live in two worlds, which is really only one world. So there's escape, no running away from relativity. My cats are caterwauling. Okay. I want to say there is no running away from relativity, or at least there should not be. You know, people do sometimes, they do all kinds of things. They take the drugs and, or they zone out, or they use Neptune artificially to escape from the responsibility which relativity, I'm pronouncing it that way purposefully, relativity demands. All kinds of escapes. But eventually we outgrow that tendency to run away, to escape. DK does talk about the Antikarana as the way of escape, but he means the legitimate meditative way of escape from normal limitations of consciousness, while not ignoring our responsibilities within those limited and limiting spheres. So again, you know, a paradox. We escape, but we don't escape. There are moments, but there are no moments. See, a moment is, if you really think about it, an extension in time. But eventually we're going to find that with what we call the process of ever lessening, or the process of infinitesimalization, God help us with such a word, infinitesimalization, that there is no definite quantity that remains a definite concrete thing. It's always an ever lessening to the point of limitation of becoming closer and closer to nothing. So the end result is that a great philosophical doctrine of superimposition exists. And all moments, or what we call moments, are ever lessenings which are superimposed upon each other, and really there's only one. Now, you know, it's a bit far out to think in those kinds of terms, but I think deep meditations can lead us to that kind of perception. Anyway, I certainly appreciate the words of the poet, and thank you for bringing them to our attention. Anything else, folks?
At this point, there is nothing else written in the chat box. Anna just provided, we not escape, but reset. Every new ray age is a new reset. Sabbath and the seventh ray is the jubilier ray, great Sabbath.
The holy day. And it's really interesting that the Sabbath is kind of a Hebrew idea. And it is so close to the planet Saturn. A Saturday, you know, it's considered, you know, you can't drive, you have to walk, you know, all those laws having to do with the Sabbath as they have been interpreted in the Hebrew religion. But it's probably much older than that. It's the day of rest, which is a little ironic when you consider that Saturn is the most workaholic planet there is, but it also is the planet that says stop. And I think the great creator is said to have rested on the seventh day. This is something that relates Saturn to the number seven, which I think it should be. I mean, there is a certain principle of order there. An escape is not really an escape, but it is removing oneself from customary limitations. And we're always at each point of tension, and they will continue to increase in intensity. There is a reset, we might say. We learn to live at higher and higher points of tension. And as we struggle to do that, there are many Saturnian difficulties. But then we stabilize ourselves. We stabilize ourselves at a new point of tension. And our progress has always to do with moving to ever more intense points of tension, intense resets, if you like, because new information, new energies are coming in with each new point of tension and with each stabilization or reset of consciousness within that new point of tension. So, yes, there is a big contrast between the occultist following the way of escape from limitation, but not ignoring responsibility, and the, you know, alcoholic, drug addict, or even there's ways to escape through music and art and, you know, other kinds of things, denying the apparent reality of the world. There's a big difference in those two approaches. So just in summary, I would say, may we always find stability, a reset, if you will, that's how you used it, at a new point of tension, a new and higher point of tension. I think, you know, in my own life, this incarnation, the kinds of points of tension at which I have lived and what kind of experiences they brought to me and what kind of energies filled my energy system when operating under those points of tension, and everything has changed progressively, deeper and deeper, more and more concentrated, more and more intense, as time, apparent time, has passed. So let us continue our climb through ever new and more intense points of tension. And that would be an ongoing resetting, resetting, resetting at ever higher levels. Thank you for your thoughts, Anna.
And I see no hands raised and no one else has written into the chat box at this particular moment. Relative.
That's right. At this particular relative moment, you know. Well, you know, you can't have relativity, unless you have division. And you can't have division of the one unless there is a refusal on the part of the one universal being to see all of itself simultaneously. So the minute there's a reduction in self-perception, which we call emanation, you have division. And you have a universe in the making, and you have the self-becomingness of the one into the many. And this is all a determination. I mean, it's almost, you know, terrible to use such words, but okay. You have a determination of the one universal life to confine its universal self-perception to less and less, to types of perception which are less and less and less than the entire all-embracing self-perception. But there is an end, you know, because in my view anyway, it is a finite universe. Every universe is a finite universe which is terminable, beginningable, which can begin and terminate in the flow of duration, in the flow of time. So at some point, the universal logos has to end its perceptual self-division and say, thus far I go and no further. And that would lead to the smallest possible unit within any particular universe. I call it a UP, ultimate particle event, and we're nowhere close to knowing even what that is. We haven't located a bubble in the koilon about which we are told in occult chemistry and in the first principles of theosophy by Jinnara Jadasa, we haven't located even that. And what if, and probably are, what if the bubbles in the koilon, which seem to be the particulates that make up everything on the cosmic physical plane, what if they are further divisible and further divisible and further divisible, albeit an end being required, because no universe, according to the great breath, is infinite in space or in time. Universes are finite extensions into objectivity of the self-perception of a universal logos. We could take that sentence apart, you know, but I'm not going to bother right now. The whole thing is about self-perception. We have a universe, any universe, because this universal logoic being observes itself, sees itself, registers itself in ever reduced form until an end is called. Okay, thanks, Kim. Appreciate your presence. Okay, is that it then?
Or is it not self-perception?
Now you're going to start sounding like Master KH or Nagarjuna, you know. They are so puzzling, some of the things said in the early Buddhist scriptures. I believe that universal self-perception, along with the process of perceptual self-reduction, is the reason we have multiplicity in universe, but not infinitude. So, you know, for me, at least, at this present stage of my own ignorance, I look at a psychological universe, which is basically, there being nothing else but the universal logos, it has to be within itself, you know, it's taking place within the very being, and all of the multiplicity are reduced aspects of that one being, at least for the moment, that's how I see it. And we all have to come to our determination regarding these things.
And then we perceive the not-self.
Well, yeah, but yeah, and then the question is there ever a not-self, you know? We call it the not-self, you know. But in the last analysis, is there such a thing ever as the not-self? That's another big question. I'm one of those universal selfers. Maybe it's like, you know, universal surfer, universal selfer. I just see oneself everywhere, or imagine that I do, and keep on trying to prove it to myself. Okay, so that's pretty much it, apparently, Michael.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so let's close with the great invocation. And I'm just grateful to you all that you have, some of you in the middle of the night, you know, have been with us, and some at a more reasonable hour.
And you're to change your screen share.
Yeah. I'm going to. I'm just kind of looking at who's here. And if I realize that this kind of work tends to do things to the mind, you know, hopefully in a way it does some good things. Because let's see, wait a second, I've got to make this work out correctly. And I'm not yet there, so I'm. It kind of is part of the process of destruction of the limitations of the concrete mind. That is, I mean, we need the concrete mind absolutely, but we also want to. Not be bound by its limitations. And that's what this kind of work actually does. So now I can get to the great invocation. And, you know, I think that it takes time to become timeless. And one has to operate in space to become spaceless. But more and more we begin to understand with Immanuel Kant what is meant by categories of consciousness or categories of the mind. We begin to understand that we are subjected to something so ever-present that we just take it as reality because it's always there. But if we try to look beneath the apparent reality of form, and the heart may detect something else that is so subtle. You know, one of the things about the Vedantists and the pursuers of the Brahmanical religion, they always dealt with something that they said, it's so subtle, it's so subtle, it's so subtle. And every once in a while, there comes a flash to the pursuer of reality that yes, it's really subtle. and maybe it's not so much the eyes, but the heart, or maybe the third eye perhaps, that can pick up how subtle it really is. How if you almost look in the wrong direction too fast, it's gone. But how it might just flash into your little universe of consciousness momentarily. We call it, I've mentioned, the blinking of the dragon's eye. Just blink. Now eventually the dragon opens the eyes, which is the same in a way as us opening our line of heart centers. And we begin to see that this subtlety is just always present as the presence. And we practice the presence like the Jesuits did. We practice the presence of God like the Jesuits. All these spiritual exercises. And sometimes it seems so removed from what is practical in the world and what has to be done. And, you know, the mega billionaires are richer than ever, and people are in food kitchen lines at this Thanksgiving. You know, this is, in the world of relativity, these are big problems that have to be solved. So, you know, like, what are you doing to solve these things? Well, we are working internally, esoterically, to help. And we're also, every once in a while, trying to really stand back. Or understand. And be that out of which all things have arisen. And it's progressive. The subtlety that we detect in a blink of the eye grows more sustained and then becomes part of our ongoing realization. I guess they're all degrees of enlightenment, right? And we're talking about ascending through points of tension, through different degrees of enlightenment. It's an initiatory process. So I certainly do appreciate the fact that in some ways, this kind of language, this kind of pursuit is very elusive. It just slips away in an instant. When you thought you had it, you don't have it. But eventually, not only do you have it, but you are it, and it is sustained. I certainly live in the faith that that is the way, because I seem to have seen that that is the way. So anyway, the idea is to thank you for, yeah, the dragon's eye and the cat's eye nebula, yeah. All around us, all forms are pointing to deeper truths, and finally, to no form at all. So thanks there, Isabel. And now the great invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. So, friends, tonight, Reappearance of the Christ, meditation, 6 p.m., and then 8 p.m. GMT, we'll have our ongoing USA vigil. Still much needed. Appreciate your presence. Thank you. And, mahalo. Okay. As Michael says. All right. Bye for now. And this will be up on Makara before long. And hopefully also on our YouTube channel. We'll talk to you later. And Love and many blessings from all of us. Bye-bye.